Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Prince Harry, fifth of the line of to the British throne, a man of enormous wealth and privilege from a family that defines British reserve, candidly revealed that he bottled up the grief he felt over the death of his mother, Princess Diana, for nearly 20 years, and that he only recently sought professional help. This has sparked a worldwide conversation with mental health advocates and celebrities all weighing in. This hour on Point, Harry's push to open up a conversation about mental health and overcoming the stigma that still exists. You can join the conversation on air or online. Have you struggled with seeking help for grief, depression, anxiety? Did Prince Harry's admission strike a chord with you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now from London is Bryony Gordon, who interviewed Prince Harry for her new podcast, Bryony Gordon's Mad World, in which guests talk about their experience with their own mental health. Bryony has also been very open and vocal about her own struggle with depression and obsessive compulsive disorder. And Bryony Gordon, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And let me just begin by saying what a scoop you landed for your podcast's very first episode.
Obviously the journalist in me was like, oh my goodness, are you really saying this? But really, what as someone who's, as you said, written a lot about my own mental health and had my own mental health struggles, and I've been sort of campaigning in the UK, to increase funding for mental health for some time. And for me, it was just a wonderful, obviously it's not wonderful. I felt intensely sad for him that he'd gone through it, but I was so proud of him. And I say that as if we're great friends. I don't really know him, but
sure.
Incredibly proud to be part of this moment where he felt that he could open up and talk about it. And he obviously did that. He knew it was almost his public duty, you know, much the same way that the Queen had to keep a stiff upper lip after her father died, you know, when she, it was sort of felt like a duty for him as a royal.
Let's. I want to hear just a couple of clips from your interview with him, just in case we've got some listeners out there that haven't heard the whole podcast. But it really gives a flavor of the kind of conversation you had with him. So here's Prince Harry talking with you, Bryony Gordon, on Bryony Gordon's Mad World, where Harry speaks really quite candidly about his struggle with grief. Here's a bit of that interview.
I can safely say that losing my mum at the age of 12 and therefore shutting down all of my emotions for the last 20 years has had a quite serious effect on not only my personal life, but also my work as well.
And then, Bryony, here's a little bit more. We're going to first hear your voice and sort of some interesting back and forth with you and Prince Harry. Here we go.
No one's ever got better from a mental health issue by not talking about it.
Exactly. And that's the thing. If you stay silent, it's more likely to kill you.
Yeah. We don't have to suffer in silence.
No, you don't.
That's the one in four of us every year. And that means four in four of us know someone, right, who's
exactly
going through something right now.
Yeah.
So, Bryony Gordon, he was, immensely open about his challenge. Did you expect that? Did you, request an interview with the prince and expect him to come and bear as much as he did?
No, not at all. I thought that he would. I met them a few times over the course since they launched Heads Together, which I should say is there in the UK. They've launched this campaign, a mental health campaign, which supports 8 mental health charities in the UK. And it's all about changing the conversation around mental health. And I was invited along to the launch last May at our Olympic Stadium in London. And I sort of got chatting to them and I've become involved with it. I offered to do the London Marathon, which is this weekend, which the Heads Together is the official charity of. So I've sort of been involved with it. And so I think maybe they felt that because I'd offered to do the marathon and run 26.2 miles or 42K or whatever ridiculous length it is, they were like, well, maybe we ought to give her something back. So we're starting this podcast and I thought, oh, She Who Dares wins. I met them a couple of times and got on with them. And to my surprise, he said yes, but I didn't expect that sort of, I knew he was going to talk about mental health because it's a mental health podcast. So it would, if he'd come on and talked about corgis, it would have been a bit odd. But, you know, like it was, I was surprised, but I mean, at the same time, the thing about Prince Harry is that he's, you know, in the podcast, you hear me saying, can I call you Hazza? Because he's so normal. He hasn't led a normal life, but he's very down to earth and he's very, you know, human. And, which we forget the royals are. And, you know, it was, so it, when I was sitting there chatting to him, it felt very much like I was having a cup of tea with a friend. And, you know, and in a way, even though we're all surprised by how candidly he spoke, I don't think anything he said was that surprising because look, we all remember the images of him and his brother aged 12 and 15, having to walk behind their mother's coffin, you know, in front of a worldwide audience, that really poignant mummy written on the, you know, on the coffin over the flowers. And you know, we all know that it must have been terrible. And you know, if you took those circumstances for someone who wasn't in the public eye, you know, parents had an acrimonious divorce, mother dies in a car crash, you know, we'd all struggle, I think. So the fact that he said that he kind of buried it all, he didn't want to confront it because it wasn't going to bring her back, and then he eventually needed to have therapy because, as you said, it was, you know, 20 years of burying his head in the sand, 2 years of total chaos.
And Brian, I want to play just a little more of Prince Harry from your interview, because I mean, one of the things he said to you was, you know, the way he tamped down all these feelings for all those years really created chaos in his life. I think he used that word. Here's a little bit more of what Prince Harry said.
My way of dealing with it was, sticking my head in the sand, refusing to ever think about my mum, because why would that help? It's only going to make you sad. It's not going to bring her back. So from the emotional side, I was like, right, don't ever let your emotions be part of anything. So I was a typical sort of 20, 25, you know, 28 year old running around going, you know, life is great or life is fine.
Yeah.
And that was exactly it.
And that's Prince Harry in an interview with Bryony Gordon, who is my guest. She interviewed the prince for her podcast, Bryony Gordon's Mad World, where the guests discuss mental health issues and how it affects their lives. And Bryony Gordon, what do you think? I mean, it seems like the overall message that Prince Harry sort of delivered to you was a pretty, I mean, and I'm not denigrating at all, but it was a pretty simple and straightforward message. It was like, if you have a problem, find a way to talk about it.
Well, yes, because that is, so we all know, you know, if you have a mental illness, one of the biggest things that if you go to a doctor, they'll give you a prescription for some antidepressants and medication, but they'll also say, go to see a therapist, right? We know that talking therapies, as we call them in the UK, are a way to get better, cognitive behavioral therapy, all of those things. No one has ever got better from a mental illness by not talking about it. You know, it may mean that it goes away for a bit. You know, it's a bit like playing whack. I don't know if you know that game where it just appears in some other form later. You know, my own experience with obsessive compulsive disorder, which I ignored, and I had a drug problem, and it was appearing in all sort of different ways until I finally, aged 34, which was like two years ago, sat down and sorted it out. And so I think Prince Harry's, as you said, it's a very simple message, and that's why it's so powerful, because it resonates with everyone. You know, we all know someone, or how many people kind of sit up and go, oh God, I'm feeling really terrible today, I'm going to go and tell someone about it. You know, we tend to just keep this stuff to ourselves, especially in Britain. You know, Prince William this week has been talking about banishing the stiff upper lip. I mean, the stiff upper lip in the UK, I can't even begin
right.
to tell
Stay
you.
Stay calm and carry on, right?
Yeah, and actually it's like, you know, you can have a stiff upper lip and be calm and still be able to kind of talk about these things. Yeah. And I think there's nothing to be ashamed of. And I think he's really kind of redefined, because I think the other thing that I took from the interview, and I certainly felt when we were sitting there, was it was quite fun. You know, we had a fun time talking, and there wasn't sort of sad music playing, and it wasn't, you know, boo. He didn't invite any pity. You know, he was sort of saying, look, this is how it was, this is how it is. And And I'm telling you, this is what you should do to help yourself. And then we can all get on with our lives and be, you know, happy or happier. And I think that was what was powerful about it. It was like listening. It was like hearing your friend chat. And, you know, we don't often hear royals talk.
Yeah,
for that long a period of time.
We're talking to Bryony Gordon about mental health and overcoming the stigma surrounding getting help after she interviewed Britain's Prince Harry, who revealed that he sought counseling to deal with his grief over the death of his mother, Prince Diana, many, many, many years after his mother was killed in a car crash. Let's go to Jessica, who's calling from Portland, Maine, one of my favorite cities. Jessica, good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. How are you?
I'm very well. What's on your mind?
Great. I'm a practicing attorney. I have been struggling with depression basically since college, probably. And I can't tell you the amount of stigma that is attached to it, especially within my profession as well. I mean, and I was working in criminal defense circles, and it's not like I could go into, you know, come home from a courtroom and say, gosh, you know, I ended up sending someone to prison for life today. You know, I feel really great about that. So let's talk about it. That, you know, those conversations never really happened at the office. So I found myself bottling up a lot of emotions and needing to talk to someone. And like, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on your name.
Bryony Gordon is our guest. Yeah.
Bryony. Yes. As Bryony was saying, it is kind of like whack-a-mole because at points you don't want to go in and talk to the therapist, and you're like, oh gosh, this is the worst. I hate, you know, sitting here talking about my feelings. Could be feeling
it's
work.
Awful.
I could be doing something.
It's awful, isn't it? Having to talk about your feelings.
Yeah, Jessica, stand by. I want to get Bryony's response to your call. What are you hearing in Jessica's call, Bryony?
Well, I'm hearing something I hear all the time. People that, you know, that also, this is a thing. We have this portrayal of people with mental illness as sort of like, you know, rocking back and forth in a padded cell. It's kind of one flew over the cuckoo's nest. And it's not. It's people like Jessica. It's people like me who are kind of high functioning. And, you know, you can, the problem is that when you kind of, a lot of people do just cope. They have to just cope. They have to bottle it up. And then you think, well, they're coming into work. They must be fine. And it's like, no, you can be in a lot of pain and still performing at a very high level, as Jessica obviously is.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about mental health and overcoming the barriers that prevent many people from getting help and suffering alone. You can join the conversation. Prince Harry urged Britons, famous for their stiff upper lip and keeping calm and carrying on, to talk about their problems. Is that also good advice for Americans? What about our tendency to overshare? I'm talking with Bryony Gordon, who interviewed Prince Harry for her new podcast about mental health issues. She's also a feature writer and columnist for the Daily Telegraph. And here's a bit of that interview from Bryony Gordon's Mad World, where we'll hear Prince Harry right now describing the moment that forced him to work through his grief and his anger about the death of his mother, Princess Diana.
All of a sudden, all of this grief that I'd never processed started to come to the forefront. I was like, there's actually a lot of stuff here I need to deal with. And that combined with being stuck in certain situations, that fight or flight, being in situations where you're at an engagement and not being able to do the flight bit, your body ends up kicking into the fight.
Prince Harry there talking to Bryony Gordon, my guest. She does the podcast, Bryony Gordon's Mad World. And let me introduce from San Francisco, Lauren Mizak, a practicing clinical psychologist and the author of the 2016 book, Acceptance of Mental Illness, Promoting Recovery Among Culturally Diverse Groups. And Lauren, good to have you. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
I'd love to just get your initial reaction to Prince Harry's revelation about seeking treatment to help with the grief over the death of his mother. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that many people may delay treatment for a number of years. And one of the things that Prince Harry talked about is having these later experiences in his charity work around mental health advocacy with veterans with PTSD and combat trauma helped him to recognize the need to seek out his own mental health care. And so I think that what he's doing is really honorable to what he learned from his mother, he indicated in the interview. And of course, I haven't personally treated or evaluated him, but he did mention that, He learned from her that you could take a position of privilege and power to smash stigma, as he says, and humanize and normalize for people just how common having a mental health problem can be. And from a cultural perspective, which is the perspective I tend to take in my clinical work and research and in the book, we see that for many men, there may be this traditional socialization process that may lead them to, in particular, be vulnerable to shutting down emotions surrounding a mental health issue.
And you say many men. Is this more common among men?
It's somewhat more common among men who've been sort of socialized in terms of traditional masculinity to avoid help seeking for a mental health problem. And he also talks about how some of his symptoms manifested in terms of aggression. And we do see depression and grief sometimes manifesting more in terms of irritability and aggression or acting out for men.
Mm. How common is, though? I mean, in Harry's case, he waited 20 years to deal with something like that. In your experience, among the people that you've had association with, how common is that?
It's actually very common. I've, you know, seen this in my clinical work and in the research as well. And, you know, there are a number of factors that Prince Harry mentioned in the interview that seem to have contributed to that, including, you know, undergoing this process in the public eye and being quite young when it happened. But people who do have unprocessed grief initially are more likely to break down later or develop a vulnerability to depression or a complicated grief experience, which is a particularly intense and prolonged grief reaction. In addition, there were some qualities of the loss that could be a risk factor for traumatic grief, like a sudden death, a death of a person who's central to one's life, like a parent, and a death that was particularly horrific and, you know, arguably preventable.
Bryony Gordon, I wanted to get you back into the conversation. The question that I have, I mean, I'll ask both of you, but let me start with you. I mean, I feel like we've been having a version of this conversation, the idea that we need to sort of get these problems out in the open, destigmatize conversations around mental health. I feel like this is a conversation that has been going on for a very, very long time, and yet we don't seem to make all the progress that we need to make on it. Why is that? I mean, first of all, is that your impression? And if it is, why is that?
I agree. In the UK, I mean, there's been in the UK, I think there's been a definite shift in the last 5 years. So that's been incredible. But I also think a lot of people talk the talk, but they don't actually walk the walk. Mm. So you go in and talk at big banks about, you know, they ask you to come in and talk about mental health, and you can see all these staff members sitting there thinking, yeah, but if I publicly had a breakdown, my boss would not put me on the next project. You know, so it's, but the point is that, you know, like it's, but only by talking about these things and by shouting about them and screaming about them and this, you know, and standing up and making them, you know, very well known, do we get to the point where it becomes part of our, you know, culture. So you do have to smash that stigma. And obviously you're not going to do that overnight. But I do feel that this week we've taken a huge leap. You know, if you think about it, the world is a pretty grim place at the moment. And yes, it's been quite nice to have something that's actually, especially in the UK, where we've got a general election announced. But there's been a definite sense of people feeling a bit like, wow, this is really cool, you know? And so I think it's, you know, it's baby steps, but it was a leap this week.
Interesting. Lauren Mizak, do you think are we making progress in smashing this stigma around talking about mental health?
I would certainly emphasize that I do believe there's a lot of hope for the progress that we're making in smashing stigma and combating stigma. I will also, you know, emphasize that stigma has been deeply ingrained in humankind, you know, throughout time, which is something that I address in the first chapter of the book, is that there's evidence to suggest that at worst in ancient times, we had this perspective that people were possessed by demons when they had symptoms of mental health problems or psychosis. And at worst, they might be chained to a wall, starved or flagellated to rid them of that possession. And, you know, currently we have ongoing problems where, as being mentioned today, people may be fired from their jobs or, you know, treated punitively for having a mental health problem or even being locked up in prison for issues related to a mental health problem.
Mm. Let's go to Diane, who's calling from South Bend, Indiana. Hi, Diane. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. I see this as a much more specific issue. Prince Harry lost his mother as a child. I also lost my parents. I was 12 when my mother died.
14 when my father died.
I'm so sorry, Diane.
It's many, many years ago, but thank you. But the invisibility of children in the grief process, this is what I see Harry talking about. When my parents died, there was basically no attention to what we were going through. And as children, we had no basis of comparison. We knew nothing about the five stages of mourning and getting through the grief process. To a child, that kind of loss just basically overshadows everything in life because you deal simply with loss, the fear of loss, and the problem being able to establish relationships because you don't want to go through that pain again. You do turn it inside. I became a cutter. I then became suicidal. This is very, very common because children automatically deal with guilt and why am I still alive and what did I do? And children basically never got any light on them. They say the worst thing that can happen is a parent losing a child, but only an adult can say that if they haven't been a child that's lost a parent because you lose everything you have. You lose your stability in life, and especially with a mother, I think even more so. But I see Harry is talking about the fact that even as a child that should have had counseling, most children just simply become invisible in the grief process.
Diane, I'd love to ask you just if you could sort of tell us a little more about your journey. I mean, as a child who suffered this, how long did it take? Did you get the help that you needed eventually, and how did that journey end up for you?
You know, I was quite fortunate. I was thrown into the foster care system, and that had its own issues. But fortunately, when I did become suicidal, I did get an incredible psychiatrist who helped me through it. I've been a very introspective person. I don't, I still am because it's always a process. But when you're an orphan, you are an orphan whether you're 50 or 60. Mm. You have that stamp on you. I have a 68-year-old brother. He's never gotten through this process. He is on his sixth marriage. I have another brother who died several years ago of gunshot. And he never got through the anger a part of it. But myself, I walked through the coals. You have to go through those steps. You can't miss a step. You have to get resolution and acceptance and make that a foundation of strength instead of something that you're afraid of.
Sure. But Diane, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story. What you told us, very powerful. Bryony Gordon, you know, there's Diane talking about, you know, the message here from Prince Harry is really should be focused on how this is a tough row to hoe for children specifically. What do you think of that?
I think Diane is an amazing woman, and I would like to jump through the radio and across the Atlantic and give her a massive hug right now. And I think she should be really proud of herself for, you know, getting through that. And I think what she said about an adult saying that the worst thing is to lose your children, but only an adult who'd never lost their parents as a child could say that, was incredibly profound and moving. And yeah, I think that the thing is we need to concentrate on dealing with, we need to teach mental health and all of those processes and issues and things like Diane said, the five issues, you know, the five stages of grief. We need to be educating children about mental health. You know, we talk to them about how to be happy and happy ever after and happy endings. But what we need to be teaching kids is how to be unhappy because it's going to happen. Do you know what I mean? And I think the best thing we can do is by starting young. But yeah, as I just Diane, you're amazing.
Let me go to one more caller. Monroe is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Monroe, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I, too, suffer with depression. I've been depressed for many, many a year. Medication definitely helps. I do have a psychiatrist that I see every 3 months, and that helps to talk about my condition. But I just wish the stigma of depression. Of course, it worked. There were some people thought I might go off the deep end, or as they say, go postal and harm somebody. And that has nothing to do with depression. It should be brought out that depression is not one of those dangerous things. Seek help and be open about it.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Lauren Mizak, I'd love you to respond to what Monroe was talking about. What needs to happen to better educate folks about depression in his case?
Yeah, I think it's an important point that the workplace is one area in which stigma can be particularly prevalent. And one of these aspects of mental health stigma, maybe this association or stereotype of people with mental health problems, is being more dangerous. Some research suggests that actually people with mental health problems, particularly severe mental health problems like severe depression, schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder, are less likely to be violent in many cases than the rest of the population, except with the presence of a substance abuse problem. So statistics like that, I think, can be really helpful in educating the public. And of course, you know, policy change like anti-discrimination laws to support people in the workplace and in other settings to be protected from potential discrimination and stigma. And to emphasize what Bryony was saying about the importance of promoting mental health literacy from a young age among the public, you know, in schools and then amongst adults as well.
Let me introduce another voice in this conversation from Boynton Beach, Florida. We're joined by Paul Gianfrido. He's the president and CEO of Mental Health America. It's a nonprofit advocacy group and lobbying organization partially funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, Otsuka Pharmaceutical, and Sunovion Pharmaceuticals. He's also the author of Losing Tim, How Our Own Health and Education System Failed My Son with Schizophrenia. Paul Gianfrido, thank you for joining us and welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you have a 32-year-old son, the same age as Prince Harry, and I imagine when you first heard about this, there must have been a moment, I don't know, of recognition, a huge sense of empathy and understanding about what Harry was talking about.
Absolutely. Well, in my son's case, the condition that he's got is different. Timothy has schizophrenia. The reality is that mental health conditions are great equalizers. Doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter what your station in life is. A lot of children are affected by these conditions. And the reality is that half of all mental illnesses emerge by the age of 14. Mm-hmm. So we very much need to be thinking about these as conditions of childhood. And we really need to be starting to deal with them in childhood. And no one should be expected to go 10 years or 20 years before discovering themselves that they need to seek help. We should be doing behavioral health screening for all of our children, and we should be taking steps now to make certain that none of our children have to go through what Harry has gone through, what my son Tim has had to go through.
And why are we still dealing with this? I mean, for a long time, I've been having these conversations as a journalist with people like you, and it seems like we continue to treat mental health treatment in this country a bit like the sort of unloved stepchild in the healthcare system. Is that still the issue, or what has to happen here?
Well, it absolutely is the issue. Here's the problem. The problem is, and it's come up already during this show, that we have used the standard of danger to self or others as a matter of public policy, as a trigger to treatment for people with mental illnesses, which has made mental illnesses the only chronic diseases in America and really in the world that we wait until stage four to treat, and then often inappropriately only through incarceration because we see them as a public safety problem, not as a public health problem. We have had to change that thinking and to get people to think about acting before stage four. We don't do our best job with cancer or heart disease or diabetes or any other condition that can become serious if left untreated by waiting until stage four. But yet, this is what we do with mental health conditions. This is what we do with mental illnesses. And this is why we've had such terrible public policy problems and such a terribly difficult time bringing people's attention upstream to thinking about early identification, earlier intervention, and the best pathways to recovery.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about grief and mental illness and when and how to get help. Earlier this week, Britain's Prince Harry revealed that he sought grief counseling nearly two decades after the death of his mother. You can join the conversation. Do you or a family member struggle with mental health issues? Do you welcome a conversation about it? What holds us back from that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And I've been talking with Lauren Mizak, a clinical psychologist in San Francisco, and Paul Gianfrido, a mental health advocate and public policy expert who leads the organization Mental Health America. We've also been talking with Bryony Gordon, a British journalist who interviewed Prince Harry for her podcast about mental health. And here's a little bit of what Prince Harry told Bryony.
I generally don't know how we stay sane. I don't have any secrets. I've probably been very close to a complete breakdown on numerous occasions when all sorts of grief and sort of lies and misconceptions and everything's coming at you from every angle.
Prince Harry there talking with Bryony Gordon earlier this week about how he kept his grief over the death of his mother, Princess Diana, under wraps for many, many years before he sought help. So let's take some calls from our listeners. Let's go to Max, who's calling from Miami. Max, good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. I just want to respond to what the panelists talked about a few minutes ago about the correlation between traditional masculine elements and the reluctance to seek mental health. It took me about 6 or 7 years to go see a therapist to treat my depression. I've been in therapy for 3 years now, and what Prince Harry has done this week, I think, is a huge step in a positive direction as far as giving other men the strength to seek help. And I think our friends across the pond deserve some credit, because I don't think the political climate here in the U.S. would allow some of our leaders to come out and describe their mental health issues with such a frankness.
Max, I really appreciate the call, and let us take up that point. I want to go to one more call to Steve, who is calling from Wacabuc, New York. Steve, good to have you. Love the name of that town, Wacabuc.
Yeah, me too. Hi, Anthony.
Good to have you.
Thanks. I lost my sweetheart 17 years ago. I expected to be life partners and have a family with her. And unexpectedly, she died from traveling while under chemotherapy with a suppressed immune system, and got an infection on an airplane flight and went into a coma and died in 2 days. And I guess like Harry, I didn't get a chance to say goodbye. And
Steve, before you go on, I just want to say, I am sorry for your loss, but thank you for the call. But please continue.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Unknowingly, I was depressed, and I shut down a lot of my energy for life. And last September 11th, I read a posting on Facebook of a man on the flight, the 9/11 flight, that where the passengers said, "Let's roll," in to take the terrorists down in Pennsylvania, to his wife, and he said, "We're going to die. I'm calling to say goodbye. I love you. I love everybody. I love my parents. Go on and keep having a good life." And I needed to hear that message. I started crying, and I'm almost crying again now. But that awakened me to how much I didn't get that chance, and I've been working on it. I did start to see a therapist. She's been very good. I have to tell you, in the middle of it a few years ago, I tried to talk about it in a group therapy. It was called Human Relations, and I was told that kind of stuff wasn't what we were talking about.
Oh, boy, Steve.
I,
But Steve, you are getting help now. You have been getting some help from a therapist.
Yeah, I tell you what, I talked about it myself on Facebook, and I got a lot of support from friends, and I've been able to talk about it more. I'm open about it. It's something I'm very glad to know, and hiding it isn't good, but being unaware and depressed was what I was. And
well, Steve, I want to really I want to thank you a lot for calling and for sharing your story. And Bryony Gordon, I mean, there's someone talking quite eloquently and powerfully about the pain and how much more difficult it becomes when you don't have a chance to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I want to jump through and give Steve a hug as well. It's like, I think, though, what Steve said, he was shut down at a group therapy session. Now, that is not good. And we hear people, you know, who go through experiences like that. But you try again. I run a thing in the UK called Mental Health Mates, which is a walking and talking group where you can go and walk and talk without fear of judgment. We actually had one in New York recently. But that's the thing, you know, for people to come together. And what I would say is that doing that, no one I know who's ever shared their story as Steve did on Facebook has ever regretted it, because you get this huge amount of positivity and huge amount of goodwill and support back. And you realize you're not alone. You know, the statistic we have in the UK is 1 in 4. I think it's 1 in 5 in America. People will experience mental health issues each year. I may be wrong, but, you know, a lot of us, it's very, very normal to feel weird. And, you know, Steve went through an awful thing. And, you know, if we talk about it, we can get through it. We can, you know, you're always going to have that pain, but you can at least process it.
Yeah. Paul Gianfrido, I want to ask you, because you wrote an article, How I Helped Create a Flawed Mental Health System That's Failed Millions and My Son. What did you mean by that? I mean, I want you, we were talking a little bit about this before the break, but say more about the flawed mental health system. But why did you phrase it like that? How I helped create a flawed mental health system that failed my son?
Well, I phrased it like that because I was a state policymaker in Connecticut in the 1980s and had control over the mental health system, all legislation related to behavioral health, all appropriations related to behavioral health. And I talk about the mistakes that my generation of policymakers made as we were moving people appropriately out of horrible custodial care institutions. We never developed the service delivery system that would support our children, support our young adults, and support our older adults with mental health concerns out in communities. As a result, all we did was ended up reinstitutionalizing a lot of folks. We closed the doors of one kind of custodial care institution called our state hospitals, and we opened up another kind of custodial care institution called our county jails and state prisons. Policymakers, to a very great extent, have doubled down on this, but in the course of the last decade or two. But I'd like to say a couple things about where there may be some hope on the horizon. First
please,
of all,
please do, please do.
Okay, yeah. First of all, with respect to men, we offer online screening tools at Mental Health America, and we get 3,000 people a day from all around the world who come and take these tools. And truth of it is, 3/4 of them are women. We've had more than 2 million people use these tools. But we are seeing opportunities to reach out to men, because young men in particular need authentic voices that they can relate to. And some of these authentic voices are from policymakers. And while we don't have our Prince Harry exactly here in the United States, my good friend Patrick Kennedy has been quite open himself about his struggles with both kinds of behavioral health problems. And I think a lot of people have been able to rally around Patrick's messaging and the messaging of some others to change the way we think about mental health, and to give some of us, frankly, the opportunity to change the way policy has been developed in the United States, particularly at the federal level during the last year, where we had significant mental health reform legislation passed by Congress and signed into law by President Obama as the last official act that he signed before leaving office, which was the most significant mental health legislation since President Kennedy signed legislation more than 50 years ago.
Can you just sum up? I mean, I don't want to get too into the weeds of legislation, but remind us what that legislation does, Paul.
Here's what it does. It lays a foundation for building the right kind of system of care services and supports from childhood through adulthood. Keep in mind, we have done very little for our children. Just as very little was done for Prince Harry when he was 12 and going through grief, very little has been done in the stories of people who've been on these calls from the time that they were experiencing grief or my son, other kinds of mental illnesses. This begins to lay the foundation for actually beginning to integrate where kids are in schools with what they need, the kind of services and supports they need to preserve and protect their mental health, for us to be able to talk about it, to educate them about it, but to educate the rest of us about what we need to do for them so that they can move on pathways to recovery, not on the kind of pathways that my son and so many other people were moved onto, those pathways to the revolving door of occasional hospitalization, frequent incarceration, and chronic homelessness, which has captured so many people.
Boy, this conversation keeps coming back to services for children, which seems so important. But let me ask you about that. I'll ask you all, but Paul, let me just stick with you. Given that children spend probably more time in school than just about anywhere else, I mean, of course, it's incumbent on parents, on families, and so forth to look out for this stuff. But it seems like you're describing a scenario there that a lot of the responsibility falls on schools. Are they equipped to do what they need to do to help children who need help?
Well, I don't want to leave the misimpression that I think teachers should bear the burden of dealing with kids' mental health problems. But I will say this. Only one child in every 28 who's got a serious mental health concern in America is currently identified as having one, only one in 28, for purposes of special education. That means that we're ignoring the compensatory services that those kids need, 27 out of 28 need, in order to survive and thrive educationally and then thrive in life. We've got to do better about that. And that's not saying the schools have to do all that, but the whole system needs to be built around supporting kids and supporting them in schools. And that means integrating community services, community care, and treatment that kids get into what's happening in the school settings. Not asking teachers to do it all, but at least giving teachers and others the resources that professionals can offer in the community to help these kids succeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Bryony Gordon, I'm wondering if in the wake of your interview with Prince Harry, you're hearing these kinds of sort of policy, you know, wide-ranging policy conversations across Britain about, you know, really what needs to happen in the way that Paul John Frieda was describing just there.
Yeah, I mean, this week we've had talk of them, talk of putting, as we have, you know, we all have school nurses, putting a mental health nurse into every school. I mean, I think it's really interesting, you know, a general election in our country has, in the UK, has just been called. And what I would really like is all three leaders of, you know, the main parties running for election to kind of make a manifesto pledge that's ring fenced towards mental health. Because at the moment in the UK, you know, again, it's the talk, but they don't walk the walk. So Theresa May said that she was going to, you know, provide extra funding towards mental health. But it gets handed over to health authorities and it's not ring fenced, so they can give it to anything else. And it's, you know, it's really important. And I think, you know, mental health is at the root of everything and it spirals off into so many other things. And as the other guests were talking about, incarceration, hospitalization, you know, social. There's so many social effects. And if you have a happy country, you have a healthy country and vice versa. You know, to me, obesity is a mental illness, really, in terms of why, you know, I mean, that's another program altogether. But, you know, overeating is an eating disorder. And there's so many different elements to it that it really needs to be at the heart of everything. It really does. And I hope that we're getting there.
Well, let's. I want to leave time for at least one or two more calls. Bethany is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Bethany, it's good to have you. What's on your mind?
Hi, Anthony. I just wanted to say thank you so much for opening up a platform for people to express themselves, to be able to speak on a very difficult topic that most of us cannot quite understand or even wrap their minds around. I'm very, very passionate about the subject of suicide and depression. I personally have lived through my father committing suicide at 6 years old and having to go through that whole process of just realizing the stigma. Like, I was so young and I had a wonderful mother who was able to teach us and give us counseling as one of the most amazing things that could have probably happened. I still have my moments where I rely on counseling. I rely on talking. I rely on community. And I rely on continually emitting positivity, and this is a station that I just randomly just put on. I'm at the Whole Foods parking lot right now. My phone's about to die here in like 10%, and I just, something inside me was like, I need to reach out to these people and say thank you, thank you, thank you, and keep on spreading the message and opening up the airwaves for people to just be free to talk and heal. It's all about healing ourselves.
Well, Bethany, you have expressed that message as eloquently as anybody on this program, so thank you for your call. Lauren Mizak, I want to come back to you. You know, a lot of your research focuses on differences in how different ethnic and gender groups, communities respond to mental illness. I'm wondering if some groups do better than others, if some groups stigmatize more than others. I mean, are there lessons that can be learned from that?
Yes, absolutely. I think from all these different cultural backgrounds in terms of gender, race, ethnicity, sexuality, etc., there are unique challenges and also resources available in the communities and surrounding those identities for overcoming stigma. You know, my book is about acceptance of a mental health problem, which we define as recognizing and actively managing the mental health problem, and stigma is one of the primary barriers to that. So one of the things that I focus on in my research is this issue of double stigma, which is the added stigma for somebody with another, you know, marginalized identity that encounters oppression experiences in addition to the mental health stigma, which might be racism, sexism, transphobia, or homophobia, for example.
Oh, boy. So extra challenges there. Lauren Mizak, I'm afraid we're up against our clock, but I want to thank you for joining us today. She's a practicing clinical psychologist in San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Big fan of the show. Thanks for having me.
And Paul Gianfrido, the president and CEO of Mental Health America. Paul, thank you as well. Appreciated everything you had to say.
Thank you, and thanks for doing this.
And big thanks to Bryony Gordon, who interviewed Prince Harry for her new mental health podcast, Bryony Gordon's Mad World. Bryony, thank you so much for bringing this interview to our attention. We're very, very grateful.
Thank you for listening, and thank you for all the callers. It's really great to hear a different perspective. I shall be writing about you all in my column this week.
I appreciate that. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.